From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Baku, Azerbaijan, at COP29. It's kind of a strange name. It stands for Conference of the Parties. It's the 29th edition. It's the 2024 United Nations Climate Change Conference. So when you hear COP29, it's the UN Climate Change Conference or Climate Summit. It's an event that aims to bring countries and problem solvers together to create something like a cohesive plan to deal with climate change. And this one just happened a few weeks ago. This year, one of the attendees, our guests for the hour, including Monroe County Legislator Susan Hugh Smith. We're going to get to how they were invited coming up. But as NPR explains, climate summits are always painstaking and fraught. And they have had some successes, most notably the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, if you want to put that in the success category. The Paris Climate Agreement calls for countries to commit to keeping global warming to well under 2 degrees Celsius, preferably to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And yet nearly a decade later, the world's on track for the hottest year on record, and levels of planet-heating pollution are projected to reach an all-time high this year. You might be wondering, why was the 2024 Climate Summit held in Azerbaijan, which is known as a petrostate? Well, one of the answers is that Russia ensured the summit was held in a fossil fuel-reliant nation by using its United Nations veto to prevent any European Union country from hosting. Perhaps unsurprisingly, this year's climate summit opened with an actual celebration of fossil fuels, followed by Azerbaijan's president declaring that fossil fuels are a gift from God. CNN's senior climate reporter Laura Pattison writes that the conference, quote, ended with a climate finance deal that developing countries called an insult, a joke, and a betrayal, end quote. Harjit Singh of the Fossil Fuel Treaty Initiative said, quote, the dismal outcomes of COP29 have raised serious concerns about the integrity of the global climate negotiation process, end quote. And Pattison concludes her reporting this way. Quote, the question at COP29 was how much wealthy countries most responsible for the climate crisis owe to poor countries facing the worst impacts. The answer, $300 billion a year by the year 2035. Rich countries said it was the best they could do. Poor countries called it abysmal, falling far below the $1.3 trillion that economists say they will need to cope with the crisis that they have not caused. And so in the wake of a chaotic, bitter summit and a heavily criticized final deal, some experts are asking whether the whole COP process is now so lacking in ambition to be almost worthless. Amid geopolitical upheaval, including the election of an actual climate denier in the United States, the 2024 summit might be remembered as the beginning of the end of multilateral climate action, end quote. As NPR reports, more than 1,700 fossil fuel industry players and lobbyists registered to attend the summit this year, and they heavily outnumbered most country delegations. Some wealthier nations didn't show up at all. Some poorer nations pulled their negotiators halfway through in disgust. The final deal seemed to anger everyone, maybe everyone except Russia. And so what did a county legislator learn from watching this international mess play out? We've got a lot to talk about this hour, and I want to thank Susan Hugh Smith for coming in, Monroe County legislator in District number 14, an adjunct professor in environmental policy at some local colleges, among many other hats. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And glad to welcome on the line with us as well, Dominic Frangillo, who is co-founder and executive director of Elected Officials to Protect America. Dominic, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Evan. Great to be here with you.
Susan, how did you get an invite to Azerbaijan? And I asked you before the program, ever been to Azerbaijan? You said, nope, this first time.
Mm-hmm.
How did this happen?
So I was fortunate to be involved with Elected Officials to Protect America. And fairly at the last minute, they got access to some credentials to attend the talks through the country of Ukraine. And I think Dominic is better positioned to explain that relationship.
Dominic, you want to take that one?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been partnering with Elected Officials to Protect America. And I should back up and say we got our start as Elected Officials to Protect New York. So we have been working for over a decade as a network of state and local elected officials across the country on climate, helping turn the tide. We've had a longstanding relationship with folks from Ukraine and have been working with them, for example, evacuating folks out of Afghanistan. We used to, one of our co-founders ran with the women athletes in Afghanistan. And so when the government fell, we worked with the government to get a plane and evacuate over 400 people. Eventually, over 4,000 people were evacuated. So we've been working with them for a while. And in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, saw the importance to and the need to help get both Ukraine off of fossil fuels while making it more secure and resilient through clean energy, and also getting Europe off of fossil fuels. So we can talk more about that later. That's how it came to be. And so we, as EOPA, helped support the Ukrainian delegation and their pavilion at COP this year.
So big goals for elected officials to protect America. Certainly big goals for someone like you who's been working on these issues, Susan. And the election happens on November 5th. It's not an outcome that you as a Democrat wanted, or as someone who's concerned with the future of climate and climate action. Was there a part of you that thought, why am I even going to this international conference? Why bother?
Oh, I mean, for sure. I woke up Wednesday morning and exactly that thought. I mean, why bother? And then my second thought was, because state and local government is going to have to step into the void, just like we did when Trump was in office before. And there's a lot of power in local and state governments. You know, California is the fifth largest economy in the entire world, like if it was a country, and New York is the 10th. We can enter into bilateral agreements with other countries, and we're just going to have to do more.
I mean, I think you can, but, and mm-hmm. I'm not being flippant here. I want to read a recent headline here before we really kind of get into what happened in Azerbaijan in this conference. The incoming Trump administration is already signaling that it might go after individual state climate actions. Now, I happen to be reading Justice Neil Gorsuch's book on a lot of different topics, but Justice Gorsuch is a big fan of federalism, which, not to get pedantic or condescending, that's not a term that I would have known very well, but it's kind of a strange term because federalism refers to really state power, the state power to have some self-direction. And justices like Gorsuch have said that there's too much concentration of federal power, that we should have laboratories of democracy, that there should be a lot of individual decision-making happening at the local and state levels, that that's good for the country generally. And so you've got states like California. In California, let me just read this headline from CBS News. Trump administration signals it might go after state climate actions. And they say California's push toward cleaner vehicles may be in jeopardy under a second Trump administration. Governor Gavin Newsom of California has a plan to phase out sales of new gas-powered cars by the year 2035, but President-elect Donald Trump has pledged to stop the state's vehicle regulation, end quote. My assumption in reading Neil Gorsuch's book is that if this goes to the Supreme Court, there may be some conservative-leaning justices who go with federalism, go with states' rights, but I don't know. And when you and Dominic talk about, hey, we know that we've got to do this at the local and state level, now you've got a federal government already signaling to you that for the next 4 years, they're going to try to stop you from doing state and local action, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt.
So what do you do?
I mean, I think you just have to continue pushing forward with the policies that you know are in the best interest of your community members, that protects public health and grows the economy. And people who value American ingenuity should be in favor of a clean energy transition. You know, people who value public health should be in favor of clean energy transition. And I think, you know, Bloomberg and Pope had a book years ago that kind of focused on the role of mayors and cities. And, you know, local government is tasked with meeting the needs of its constituents in a more direct way than probably any other form of government. And an energy transition is a win-win-win. It protects people, it grows the economy, it makes communities a more attractive place to locate businesses. And I think those of us who understand that fact will continue to work towards policies that are in everybody's best interest. And we can't control whether the Republican Party under Trump, which is not the Republican Party of certainly my childhood, or most of the people I respect from that side of the aisle. But they are against capitalism. They are fundamentally against innovation. And if they want to live in the past and, in fact, not be the party of states' rights, then I guess we have just a completely new world order. So I'm really not interested, and to some extent, in their lies and their falsehoods. And I think we're just going to have to, those of us who care about people are going to have to continue to push and look for avenues and opportunities to, keep our community safe.
Don't be deterred.
No, I mean, you can't be. Well, otherwise, you're just, you know.
Well, let me ask Dominic about that. So the second chapter of Gorsuch's book, it tells the story of Butte, Montana, which has a remarkably high concentration of cancer cases, childhood cancer, way, way above normal rates. And it turns out that industry that had been operating there appears to have been behind a lot of really dangerous pollution and contamination. And so the locals in Butte wanted to do two things. They wanted to clean up their own property, and they wanted to pursue some kind of action that said, hey, the industry, the coal operators, the miners, have been putting stuff in the ground that's killing us. But there was a federal standard on, and not to get all sort of wonky, but there was a parts per million federal standard on this stuff. And what the people in Butte said was, that federal standard's nowhere close to good enough, because it allows these companies to operate in a way that, yeah, they can keep extracting, but people are dying. We think it should be at X. And the local government and the state government agreed. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And in 2019, the Supreme Court said, no, the federal standard has to apply. And Neil Gorsuch, a conservative justice, said the Supreme Court got it wrong, that there should be state allowance to say our standards are going to be different. Our standards are going to be higher. And if you want to operate here, here are the rules. So I think he would say, Dominic, that if New York wants to ban fracking, New York should ban fracking. And if Pennsylvania doesn't, Pennsylvania won't. And if New York wants to have a different standard on ground contamination from different energy operations, you should do that. You have elected leaders. You're going to pass laws. You're accountable to the people. My guess is the Trump administration will go after California, as they've already signaled they're going to do for automobiles. They may go after New York for fracking. I don't know what's going to happen, but do you look at this and say, yes, we went through this from 2017 to 2020, but this is an administration that's much more prepared this time around to go after what we're trying to do, Dominic?
Exactly. And we just held, right before the election, in briefing, national briefing with Attorney General of New York State, Letitia James, where we covered exactly this these details, just how prepared the administration is through a 922-page guidebook, Project 2025, listing out a sweeping set of executive actions and plans, from dissolving the Department of Education to gutting the EPA to everywhere in between. So really a wholesale radical change at the federal level aimed at explicitly dismantling federal environmental protections, health protections. And this is the reality that we're facing as a country. And we see that no more clearer than in the climate arena, where the companies that you're talking about that are, you know, fighting at every turn to have federal protections and safety protections for our public health, pollution standards, are now going to be using the levers of power explicitly through the incoming administration, which met with the oil companies and basically made the pitch. Hey, give me $1 billion to win the election and I'll do your bidding. And so that's exactly what American voters should be, and we're all expecting to happen. And so now it's up to us at the state and local level to do everything that we can to defend. I think the argument about states' rights is just one that's convenient, because as you pointed out, when the conservatives, the radical right is controlling the federal government, it flips to, oh, sorry, we are now doing things at the federal level. So that we really need to recenter the conversation on how can we best protect public health? How can we best protect our communities? How can, as Sue said, we drive innovation, prosperity through clean energy jobs that can't be outsourced? And that's the work really at the state and local level that we'll need to double down on and do everything we can in the next 4 years.
Talking to Dominic Frangillo, co-founder and executive director of Elected Officials to Protect America, and in studio, Susan Hugh Smith, who is a Monroe County legislator and has been working on climate action for a number of years and teaches environmental policy at some local colleges. Just briefly, they both were at the in Azerbaijan earlier this month at the UN annual climate conference, which has been pretty roundly criticized from just about everybody. I don't know anybody who left there and was like, that was great. Although the Biden administration says that the deal that was reached was a good one. We'll get to that in a second. But just generally, you know, it's easy for me, Sue, to look at, well, you know, Azerbaijan's president opened the conference with saying that God has blessed fossil fuels and there should be a celebration of fossil fuels. And it's easy for me to sort of sneer at that. And I think that there's a risk in that sort of elitist reaction that maybe I have to, because Azerbaijan is not the United States. They're not the same situation. Different countries are facing different crises. And part of the whole conference was about figuring out the wealthy versus the poorer countries and who owes what. But was it as messy as all the reporting? I want to know from your perspective, was it pretty cohesive and harmonious? Or were you like, what are we doing here?
I mean, it was an amazing experience. It was a place I never thought I would have the opportunity to go and see what was happening firsthand. So from sitting in actual, you know, negotiation sessions, listening to people hammer out details, preventing pushback on language around the rights of women, for example. It's not gotten a lot of attention in the news, but that was important. Women are the most impacted around the world by climate change, and protecting them and moving their rights forward is a way to help uplift and address climate action. So, yeah, it's messy, but negotiations are probably always messy, and you're never going to get everything you want. Personally, I found to be around so many thousands of people from around the world who are committed to not giving up, who had the message, we're not going to let the United States policy deter our success, was, you know, restorative. To meet other elected officials from around the country who are all in, who are committed to continuing the fight to do what we know is right. Like, losing is not an option for humanity. And I think that that message and that feeling of the U.S. is isolating itself, the U.S. is walking away from leadership, and there are plenty of other actors who are happy to fill that void, China being one of them. And, you know, Americans need to decide, you know, who they want to lead the world. And if they're satisfied with being relegated to the history books, then, yeah, let's not do anything. But if we really want to position ourselves and our children for prosperity, then civil society is going to have to make the decision that their local governments, their state governments need to step up, and we all collectively need to work together to prevent the federal government from undoing everything that actually has made our lives comfortable and healthy.
What were people saying to you, your colleagues from around the world, about the recent election?
You know, they were concerned about a climate denier in the White House. And I think whether it was the state reps from Nevada and New Mexico and California and Washington, governors included, Senators Markey from Massachusetts, like, we were all there with the same message that California, New York, other states have power and influence. The biggest economic drivers in the country, I think it's the 7 of the 10 biggest, I think it's states, are voted for Harris. We voted for progressive policies to move climate action forward. And we're going to continue working to that end. And a lot of people were happy to hear that. And there was a lot of, like, I got to participate in 3 different panel discussions, all focused around local action, what cities and other governments around the world are doing. And that is encouraging.
Okay, those are the encouraging parts.
For sure.
What were the parts that you looked at and said, this is not good?
I mean, it's easy to criticize it as a complete failure, but I would submit to you that you don't have 29 meetings and fossil fuel emissions continue to rise, and any sane person look at that and think that this system is working. Like, I struggle to believe that the solution to climate change, we need federal government to play a role. Don't get me wrong. They can do a lot to derail things. Biden's IRA has done more than anything to move climate action forward. The federal government can accelerate or decelerate a lot. But basic economics have shifted now, and a lot of the renewable energy transition, if you don't pursue it, you're just assigning more costs to people. But at the end of the day, climate change will be solved because businesses, civil society, like regular people, nonprofits, and so forth, are partnering with local governments, state and local governments, to move action forward because the national interests are too fraught with, quite frankly, corruption, influence of moneyed groups. And I include the United States in that.
Before I turn to Dominic, one other point on your experience in Azerbaijan at this conference. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of talk about the influence of the fossil fuel industry, the hundreds of lobbyists, the people who are trying to influence meetings, Azerbaijan's leadership praising. What would you caution us, you know, those who start to sneer at, like, why are they doing this in Azerbaijan? And, mm-hmm. you know, like, that's ridiculous. What would you caution about that? And how mm-hmm. prevalent was sort of the shadow of fossil fuels over this?
So I guess the first part of that, I would say look at what the United States is doing. Like, would it really be better to host it here? We've been the historically biggest emitter ever. We are a net exporter of fossil fuels right now. So, you know, don't throw stones in glass houses, right? Like, I see it not as my job to criticize Azerbaijan when our own house isn't in order. You know, we're not leading and we haven't for decades. So.
Okay, fair enough. But how significant was the presence of the fossil fuel industry?
You know, what I saw a lot more of personally was the peddling of false solutions like hydrogen. And my favorite, most amusing conversation was actually with the energy minister of Saudi Arabia. They have a big display over, green hydrogen. And so I asked him, so green hydrogen comes from water. Are you desalinating the water before you are producing the green hydrogen? And hoping to find out what then they would be doing with all the salt that they would be collecting. And his answer was such that either their energy minister knows nothing about basic chemistry, or he thought the person he was speaking to would know nothing about basic chemistry. And it was just, it was laughable.
But hydrogen mm-hmm. is not the future then?
I think hydrogen has an important, critical, niche role to play. But the amount of energy it takes to produce hydrogen will not make it a solution for
Are
us.
Are you claiming that Saudi Arabia was propagandized?
Crazy. Crazy to consider.
Is that right? Yeah. Dominic Frangiello, how would you describe your experience there, both sort of the positive and negative?
Absolutely. I mean, your question about presence of fossil fuels, this is nothing new. And the fact that COP29 is COP29 that we've been negotiating for 30 years now as a world about how we are going to handle the most critical emergency that we've ever faced as humanity really plays. I mean, I would say that it's designed to work. It's working exactly how it was designed to work as a process. Look in contrast, for example, to the WTO, World Trade Organization, and other agencies or international negotiation processes that are pushing through deregulation and neoliberalism of economies. Those happen in just a couple of years, whereas the countries like Saudi Arabia, like Russia, like the United States that have a huge fossil fuel-based economy, it is the idea of the world transitioning off of fossil fuels is a fundamental threat to those powerful interests that have disproportionate sway in their economies and in their politics. And look, for example, at the OPEC nations. You go down the list of all of the OPEC nations and oil-producing nations. Almost everyone is an autocratic dictator. And we really see that in Russia, just how much of a threat fossil fuels can be to the world, where fossil fuels are literally funding the war in Ukraine right now. For every woman, man, child in Europe has funded personally $400 to Putin to pay for the bombs and the missiles that are going into Ukraine. So the idea that fossil fuels are a critical path to the future is just not true. It's a path to disaster, and we've seen it's fundamentally destabilizing the world. And so we shouldn't be surprised that fossil fuel lobbyists are if they were a country delegation, are the largest delegation. So what I've found as hope, though, and to say that it was only 2 years ago in COP27 for the first time, the words fossil fuels were even mentioned in the negotiating text after 27 COPs. So that it shows just how much power the fossil fuel industry has and through the governments that are then negotiating on their behalf. So that's why one of the hopes that I've taken out of COP was just how much progress is being made for a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty. And we've been delighted to partner with our partners at the International Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is calling for a full, fast, funded phase out of fossil fuels focused on helping rich countries support poorer countries, developing countries, in being able to move beyond oil, move beyond gas, move beyond coal that is poisoning our communities and our democracy and our climate. So we've seen major progress forward on that front, and we're delighted to help support. They had their second ever ministerial meeting. Folks from almost every continent participating, ministers from the Pacific, Southeast Asia, Latin America, Caribbean, as well as observers from Africa and Asia and Europe, who are interested in, let's reframe this. Let's get to the root of the problem, which we know, depending on how you look at the accounting, between 75% and 90% of global emissions are caused by fossil fuels. Historically, let's get to the root of the problem and actually work together to phase out. And so that, for me, is one of the most exciting things to come out of it. It's not through the official deal, but it's through realizing, okay, we need to come together to help drive this agenda forward.
Let me ask our guests who were there just briefly, and again, this is not necessarily the focus that Susan Hugh Smith and Dominic Frangillo have when it comes to climate work, because you're not international negotiators hammering out
right.
a multi-year agreement. Mm-hmm. But I do want to know what it was like coming out of that, because the big deal that got signaled coming out of the UN Climate Summit this year, again, if listeners remember, France and Paris 2015 was Paris Climate Accords. You don't always get something like that people will remember for years. But this one was about making sure that, whether you want to describe it as the Global South or poor countries, get supported by the bigger polluters and the richer countries, so that if we're really going to move away from fossil fuels or we're really going to move towards sustainable and cleaner energies, that people can afford it and not collapse their economies, and what it's going to cost. Well, a group of economists said it's going to be about a $1.3 trillion a year that the richer countries should be funding to the poorer countries around the world to do this. The deal that got struck was that by 2035, so a decade from now, $350 or $300 billion a year. What was it, Sue?
It was
$300 billion mm-hmm. a year. So $1 trillion less than economists say mm-hmm. is needed. Now, the Biden administration defended the deal. President Biden had called for $250 billion a year, but he said that this is an ambitious deal that will help speed the transition to cleaner economies around the world. European Union Commissioner Wopke Hoekstra, who is from the Netherlands, echoed his support for the new agreement. Meanwhile, some representatives from poor countries literally left early. They were furious. So there's a lot of emotion around this. What does that deal look like to you? Is this sufficient?
Oh, it's not. It's not even close to sufficient. But I think,
why is the Biden administration saying it's a good deal?
I don't know. I can't speak for the Biden administration. You know,
as a Democrat, you should speak for all Democrats. No, I understand. I understand.
Yeah. But I think, when people hear $1.3 trillion a year, it's very easy to think, well, obviously we can't afford that. But the context is that governments around the world are subsidizing fossil fuels to the tune of $13 trillion annually. So it's not that there's no money. It's that we need to redirect our money, whether that's local subsidies, you know, the state subsidizes fossil fuels, you know, or national governments. Like, there is money. We just need to start shifting the money away from that which is destroying us and our communities to that which will restore the stability of the climate system, improve public health, and grow the economy. Like, I don't know. It doesn't seem like a tough choice to me. It's just that the political power rests in the hands of those fossil fuel interests, of the handful of people in the world who, yeah, think fossil fuels is a gift for God because it's making them obscenely wealthy. But the world over, the rest of us are suffering for that.
Dominic, what do you make of the final agreement that came out of this UN climate conference?
I think Sue is exactly right. I mean, it's $13 trillion in global subsidies. That's two fossil fuels we need to have. We're just simply asking, and poor developing countries, the Global South, is calling for, hey, let's take at least one-tenth of that a year in climate finance to help get developing countries off of fossil fuels. And so, you know, India, Nigeria, we're accusing the COP presidency of pushing this deal through without their proper consent. So they, and that's why folks were leaving. And it's no surprise. I mean, Russia put their thumb on the scale to make sure that COP this year was being held in a fossil fuel petrostate closely aligned with Russia. So it's not a surprise. But you look at the last three COPs are actually held in fossil fuel producing countries for similar reasons. This is just shows the power of this industry to help sway the outcome. And we saw that in the agreement. We failed to reach this year a global agreement on how last year's global stock take, which needed to move forward, including a pledge to transition away from fossil fuels, how would that take forward? That was then punted to next year in Brazil. So all eyes are going to be on COP30 next year in Brazil. That being said, we actually did see some progress in Article 6, which is allowing countries to voluntarily cooperate with one another to determine their nationally determined contributions, meaning what they will be doing to help lower emissions. We did see agreement on that, on the carbon markets, which has been great. So that means all the elements of the Paris Agreement have finally been finalized 10 years after it was signed. And we're proud. Actually, we do have a negotiator on our team. Our co-founder, Andy Katz, who's an elected official out in California, was part of those negotiations. So we have seen some progress, but yes, overall, we're nowhere near on the finance side where we need to be. That being said, you know, the United States, I think, and President Biden deserves applause. We have gone in as the United States with the largest investment in clean energy and climate transition in global history with the Inflation Reduction Act, over $369 billion invested in local communities to help reduce, not just reduce emissions, but creating jobs for clean energy, upgrading homes. And that's where our work will need to transition after COP, focusing on making sure those investments continue to come, even with the new administration. That's why 80% of those investments were in Republican-leading districts, because once it will be a lot harder to take away. Well, they've already, you know, Republican members of Congress, for example, have already gone to ribbon cuttings and you know, opening new factories. We've seen a historic number of new factory openings focused on clean energy. So those job creation figures, those will continue to rise. And that's where we really face a choice as a nation, as cities and as states, local governments, where are we going to continue to focus our effort? And that's going to be, let's continue to get the work done locally. And the reality is that 71% of jurisdictions that in the United States, states that have signed saying we are still in the Paris Agreement, regardless of what the Trump administration will do, 71% of the America's economy is represented by those jurisdictions. So America is still in, will continue to be still in the Paris Agreement with over 71% of America's economy represented, regardless of what the Trump administration does. But it's up to us at the state and local level to make sure that we implement it.
We're talking to Dominic Frangillo, co-founder and executive director of Elected Officials to Protect America, Susan Hughes-Smith, who is a professor of environmental policy in local colleges, a Monroe County legislator. Both Susan and Dominic were attendees of the recent United Nations Climate Change Annual Conference. This one happened in Azerbaijan. 14 hours via plane and transfers and delays and what have you to get to the conference, attended by many nations from around the world, not without controversy. But now we're talking about what comes out of that and then what happens at local and state levels. So before the hour's up, we're going to ask both Dominic and Susan to have us thinking a little bit about what is on their, you know, maybe their agenda, their wish list, their priority list, especially for 2025. But let me also briefly just touch on a point, and I'll ask you about this, Susan. You just heard Dominic talking about the states that are saying, whatever Trump decides to do with Paris, we're still in. Big parts of our economy, still in. There is an ongoing, you can call it a debate, a propaganda campaign, in a lot of different directions about what is the more economically viable future. Set aside climate change. There's this idea that fossil fuel interests, and frankly, a lot of elected leaders, including the president-elect, have, which is that if we wanted to actually aggressively move systemically to cleaner energy, it would cripple us. And I know that this drives you nuts, and I know we've talked about this many times, but let me ask you a question in this way. If you are right, if we can actually mitigate the worst results of climate change and have a strong economy, why hasn't that become a dominant theme in the discourse here and in other countries yet, if that is true? Isn't the market a powerful player? Wouldn't there be profit-seeking interest that would be pushing this more quickly in that direction if that were true?
I think the market is a powerful player, and I think things are moving incredibly quickly in certain places. And why isn't the media covering it? Because apparently not everybody's as good as Evan Dawson.
That's going to get you nowhere.
Yeah. So, you know, you look at Republican states, red states, right? Iowa's got 30% of their electricity supply coming from wind. So clearly wind works. They're not doing it because they're tree huggers. They're doing it because it's economically the sensible thing to do. You know, at the talks, again, Saudi Arabia had a nice display about producing solar at 2 cents kilowatt. You know, I mean, 2 cents? I'd like some 2 cents electricity. You know, it is the cheapest form of electricity production today in certain, you know, regions. And so I think if you look at you know, people can go to World in Data, I think is a great website.
Yeah, Our World in Data is
great.
Yeah,
Our World in Data. And you start looking at the changes, right? Change begins slowly and then it accelerates. And you see kind of like an exponential growth in a lot of markets, right? Solar, wind, batteries are poised to do that too. And so the market is signaling that change is happening. And we should talk about it more.
Well, And you're talking about it in a way that is pocketbook centric. Mm. It's economic security centric. And that's not to say that there isn't a place in the future for conversations about morality. Mm-hmm. And when we talk to younger climate activists, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, your kids and people like former Congressman Bob Inglis talked about his kids talking to him. There often is that real moral urgency. Mm-hmm. I think we are seeing in the most recent election, and I'm not trying to draw too quickly mm-hmm. a conclusion here, but the culture war is not a great way to win big elections, especially when people feel like there's a ton of economic inequality. You have to convince people mm-hmm. that this is a good thing for them economically, sure. for their job security, for their pocketbook,
sure.
even before you get to the moral question. Do you agree
sure.
with that now?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're driving an electric car, you're paying $1 a gallon for gas. Which isn't gas, right? The electricity equivalent is. Like, it's an economically smart decision to make. The challenge is, of course, in many of these technologies, is you can't, we don't have the system we have in place today because we asked individuals to make decisions in their economic interest that were fossil fuel choices. Like, we have, in New York State, built out the gas infrastructure for home heating on the backs of other ratepayers. We're not individually assuming that cost. We're collectively assuming that cost. And what we need is our leadership, our political leaders, to realign that set of interests so that the utilities have to start dismantling the gas infrastructure and certainly not expanding the gas infrastructure and instead be collectively putting in place the alternative, which is more energy efficient, which will be economically better for all of us to do. We can't put that burden on individuals alone to make that happen because we don't all have that money up front to reap the long-term cost-effective rewards.
Dominic, you want to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And just to your point about why is the narrative of clean energy not more salient and powerful? Well, actually, U.S. automakers are telling the incoming administration, please continue to force us to sell electric vehicles, literally. That's what they're asking the incoming Trump administration to do. Don't axe the rules that require us to sell electric vehicles. Why? Because we know that this is where the world, they know this is where the world is headed. And if we do not, as an American economy, as our automakers and American automakers do not sell electric vehicles, we'll be outcompeted and out undercut by China and India and other electric vehicle automakers. There is a strong and growing presence of American clean energy industry. I was just at the American Clean Power Conference on offshore wind. Offshore wind has the power, has the ability to power the U.S. twice over with clean electricity, far from the coastlines, floating offshore wind turbines that are powering the America where it's needed most, which is on the coast, and then we can fill in obviously with transmission and clean energy, the rest of the country. That's unprecedented. It's the largest industrial project, job creation project in American history. However, fossil fuels continue to be, the power of fossil fuels is that they concentrated power. They're concentrated energy, but they also create massive concentrations of wealth, concentrations of wealth and power, both politically and economically. Whereas clean energy is creating far more jobs than dirty energy, than fossil fuels. The World Economic Forum says there are now more clean energy jobs on planet Earth than fossil fuel ones. They outnumber fossil fuel jobs. However, the political power is what's concentrated, and that is what makes wealthy states, fossil fuel states, like Russia, like the other OPEC nations, Saudi Arabia, be able to not want to let go of that. And that's why it's so important that we do talk about how clean energy is democracy energy. It's distributed energy. It's something that we can all produce on our roofs, in our communities, that we can generate local prosperity, community prosperity for us as a nation from the bottom up. And you know who understands this the most? Ukraine. One of the most striking things at the climate talks was a solar panel at the Ukrainian pavilion that was hit by a Russian missile. And now, obviously, we know that Russia has been targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure because it takes over a year to replace and repair the gas power plants, or many months to replace the transmission lines and fossil fuel infrastructure. But that solar panel, that was replaced within 24 hours. It can create more resilience for Ukraine. They've built a wind farm of 19 turbines in a war zone, 90 miles from the front line. They are still standing over a year later because it takes $1 million missile for Russia to hit one of those wind turbines. They're like toothpicks standing in the field. So it costs more to destroy the wind turbine than it does to rebuild it. So this is an example of how Ukraine knows that its security, its very existence, depends on moving off of fossil fuels to distributed clean energy that can help it be more clean and resilient right now, but also in the larger geopolitical sense. We need to get Europe and the world off of fossil fuels that are funding, literally funding these fossil fuel dictators and fossil fuel bombs and fossil fuel missiles. This is the way that we can protect our democracy, protect our prosperity, and protect and create a health and safety world, world of health and safety for all moving forward through clean energy.
All right, let me get some feedback from listeners. Andrew in Irondequoit first. Hello, Andrew, go ahead.
Hey, you guys. Don't forget about nuclear, small nuclear modular, I think they're called modular stuff. Anyway, the small nuclear is taking off in the stocks lately. So don't forget about that, too. That'll help you guys get to your energy utopia that you're all dreaming about. Okay.
Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate that. Sue Hughes-Smith, what do you think?
I have long said I want all the fossil fuels gone before we dismantle any nuclear, and I have always been open to some role for nuclear power.
Okay. That's not an endorsement of new nuclear.
I'd like to see the fossil fuels go away first. And the fact is renewables are faster to build and cheaper to build. I am open to some discussions on nuclear in a limited capacity.
Dominic, briefly, nuclear?
If you want to see climate activists really duke it out, just invite them all to a session on nuclear power.
I mean, there's not a consensus on this. It's true.
Yes. I mean, the reality is that the greatest threat to life on Earth is if we overheat our planet and it becomes uninhabitable. We're looking at the stream of the ocean literally shutting down, which would fundamentally change, and scientists are already seeing this, would fundamentally change our climate system and weather patterns. So we just the sheer threat. So we need to look creatively at all the options out there. Our membership as elected officials to Protect America is spread across the spectrum. So we're focused on what are the solutions that can help solve this crisis, create jobs, as Sue said. You know, clean energy jobs are cannot be outsourced. And, you know, large nuclear plants or large fossil fuel plants, they're very capital intensive, but that means they're less job focused. So if we want to create jobs, create prosperity, and make sure that's distributed so that we can across the country, then clean energy is definitely the best way to do that.
All right. In Brighton, this is Reese next. Hello, Reese. Go ahead.
Oh, Reese.
Luis, go ahead.
I just had a question, ask opinion about. I know that Metro Justice has been doing a campaign to try to just explore the possibility of moving RG&E away from a private corporation owned by, I forget the name now, some Spanish multi-conglomerate corporation into public utilities. And part of the argument has been, you know, if creates opportunities to deal with moving into more renewable energy as a community and not in an individual basis. I don't know if this is kind of connected. I wanted to see what your guests thought about that.
Susan?
Sure, definitely is connected. Absolutely. I have asked RG&E leadership when I've had an opportunity to speak with them to, for example, come out in favor of the Heat Act, New York Heat Act, which would align utility law with climate law. I've asked them to stop funding disinformation campaigns that prop up fossil fuels and to get all in on the energy transition. I also think that it is perhaps, why isn't it the role of local government to ensure that our community has access to heating and cooling? Why isn't that a basic service? And so those are some questions that I think would be relevant. Yeah.
Okay, Diane called in. She wanted a fact check on Susan Hughes-Smith's claim that governments around the world subsidize fossil fuels to the tune of $13 trillion annually. The International Monetary Fund, according to The Guardian, found that it was around $7 to $8 trillion in 2022, but the current number, $13 million a minute in subsidies around the world for fossil fuels. So whatever the actual number, 7, 8 trillion, 13 trillion, I don't know your source on the 13 trillion. I'm trying to find it here, Susan.
Oh, my source is Elected Officials to Protect America.
So
actually, no, it was at one of the UN climate talks.
Clearly, the actual number, whatever the actual number is, is far more than what the UN agreement ended up being for what richer countries need to subsidize poorer countries to deal with climate, cleaner energy. We're down to just about a minute here. So in these final 30 seconds from you, what are you going to work on the most in 2025 that you want people to have their eyes on?
Well, the most immediate thing is I'm looking at submitting an amendment to the county budget that gets voted on in December. I would like the tax money from the sale of gasoline to be directed So not a new tax, but a sales tax that's already coming into
existing tax.
Existing tax. I would like that money to be earmarked for the implementation of phase two of the climate action plan, which is the community plan, because the only way we're going to really get participation is if there is some financial assistance for all the various potential projects.
Do your colleagues support this?
Probably not enough of them, but I hope so.
We're going to see. All right, real quick, Dominic, what's on your agenda? About 30 seconds.
Well, we'll be focused as a network of state and local elected officials across the country in defending our democracy, making sure that we are moving forward at the state and local level to create jobs, ensure our prosperity by advancing clean energy projects, building electrification, energy efficiency. These are jobs that can't be outsourced and are too important to leave the global stage. So we'll be doing everything that we can to move forward locally as elected officials to protect America.
Thanks, both Evan. Both of our guests this hour attended the recent UN Climate Conference in Azerbaijan. Dominic Frangillo, co-founder and executive director of Elected Officials to Protect America. Thanks for coming on the program.
It's been a delight.
Susan Hughes-Smith, a Monroe County legislator. Will you come on and maybe spar with one of your colleagues if you don't have agreement on this redirecting existing tax?
Sure.
This is an interesting idea. It's made for this program to have a conversation.
Sure is. We'd love to.
All right, let's do that soon. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And more connections coming up in just a moment.